available on digital media, iTunes podcast, smartphone apps, and from the online website, the talking newspaper for Coventry. This is Outlook.
Hello and welcome from me, Ashley Haywood, to Outlook, which is being recorded on Wednesday the 13th of August 2025. We're going to visit the village of Mansetta before hearing more about the palm trees of California and a remarkable women's orchestra in Auschwitz. We make an out-of-season visit to the south coast before continuing to hear more about Dave's trip north of the border. Nigel's also going to give us some gardening advice before setting us a little conundrum. All of this in addition to the sports news, your postbag, and an update from the Hub. But firstly, we have the week's local news, read today by Peter and Elaine.
Outlook News.
A block of flats in Coventry was evacuated after a major flood in the building, with displaced residents moved to the city's central library. Citizen Housing, which manages Mercia House in the city centre, said a leak in the sprinkler system was to blame, with four floors of the building directly affected. West Midlands Fire Service said it was called to the 17-storey block at about 10:50 BST last Friday. The fire service said crews had worked to isolate supply and stem the flow of water. Kerry Pritchard, a resident who lives on the fifth floor, described how she was at work when she got a text from her landlord to tell her there was a major leak. "I've been told there was a water leak in the sprinkler cupboard," she said, "and the water filled up quite high in the cupboard, and it's all flooded downstairs into several flats, affecting four floors. I don't know when we'll be able to go back in, but there is support available from Citizen Housing and the council, so we will be looked after," she said. Head of repairs at Citizen Housing, David Polhill, said, "Due to the escape of water, we have had to turn the water and power off, which has resulted in the need for us to temporarily rehome residents as we fix the problem." The firm said it would temporarily rehome residents, and Peter Gill, Director of Housing Care and Support at Citizen Housing, said in a statement on Sunday that the arrangement would be extended until Friday as a precaution. Pearl Miller, who has lived in the building for more than 30 years, said she had been moved to the Hotel Ramada with her partner, but has requested a move to a room with a fridge, as they cannot store his insulin. She has also had to buy a number of items after she was unable to get them from her flat due to strict visiting rules. "Citizen have just said that it's too dangerous to go in," she said. "Whenever you ask them when we can get back in, all they ever say is they can't say." In a statement, Mr. Gill said, "The safety of our customers remains our top priority." He added, "We're contacting all customers to let them know that once we've got the power and water back on, we'll be contacting them to arrange an appointment so that we can check their home safely. We know this is not ideal for our customers, but we'll continue to support them in any way we can until we get them back into their homes safely."
Firefighters have been busy because they had to race to a huge building fire on the outskirts of Coventry. A total of 9 fire engines, as well as 2 West Midlands Fire Service response vehicles and a hydraulic platform, were called into action at a waste management facility at Meriden. At the height of the operation, there were 60 firefighters involved to tackle the fire, which had swept through the roof of the building. Several engines remained at the scene off Cornet's End Lane overnight. Fortunately, no one was injured in the incident, which broke out late on Monday afternoon. However, major damage has been caused to the building. Black smoke could be seen billowing from the roof as crews battled to stop the flames from fully engulfing the building. The update from the fire service on Monday night explained that 8 fire crews plus specialist teams and resources remain at the scene. "We're planning to reduce our presence shortly, although we expect to remain at the site through the night. A number of agencies have been involved in the response, and we continue to work closely with the businesses affected to ensure that their operations can continue. Firefighters continue to identify, expose, and extinguish any remaining hotspots with support from on-site staff. Specialist fire investigators are set to be at the scene for the remainder of the week. This is part of works to find out the cause of the blaze, the West Midlands Fire Service spokesman explained.
Average speed cameras have gone live on 6 major routes in Coventry. 6 roads with a 30-mile-per-hour speed limit have recently had them installed. Cameras have been placed on Moseley Avenue, Four Pounds Avenue, Wheelwright Lane, Holbrook Lane, Alderman's Green Road and Parrott's Grove. Coventry City Council determined which roads needed the new traffic cameras in partnership with West Midlands Police. Cameras have been installed on the busy city roads to improve safety and reduce speeding. Others installed across the city have contributed to a 40% reduction in personal injury crashes, according to Transport for West Midlands. Councillor Patricia Heatherton, Cabinet Member for City Services, said, "Cameras will keep people safe and reduce the number of people killed and seriously injured on our roads. We have shown with the other schemes we have introduced across the city that these cameras work to reduce the severity and number of personal injury collisions." She continued, "Data will be collected and analysed to show how driving at speed can increase the risk of collisions and injuries. Road safety is a priority for Coventry City Council, and avoidable collisions caused by speeding and driving dangerously affect many people. So anything done to reduce this is great news for all residents."
The BBC has confirmed that there will be no second series of the Stephen Knight drama, This Town. Released in March 2024, the 6-part series delved into the ska and two-tone music scene in the Midlands in the early 1980s amidst violence on the streets of Birmingham and Coventry. Filming took place in Birmingham, the Black Country, Wolverhampton, Coventry and Stoke-on-Trent, as well as at the new studio hub in Digbeth, set up by the Peaky Blinders creator. Speaking about the drama last year, Knight said, "At the time it seemed completely normal, but when you look back, there was a period when in Coventry and then Birmingham a certain sort of music appeared. Suddenly everyone seemed to come together regardless of differences like race. You'd go to a Birmingham football match and go to the pub after the match and someone would turn up with a record player and plug it in and everyone was united. I thought it would be interesting to tell the story of that time. I tried not to tell a story of 4 people who form a band, but of 4 people in very, very difficult circumstances which they can only escape from if they form bands." Confirming the news, a BBC spokesperson said, "We're hugely grateful to Stephen Knight, Kudos and the cast and crew for bringing this town to life. In no small part due to Stephen's passion for the West Midlands. We look forward to working with him on new projects in the future, and we're in talks about what's next." Just a few months ago, the series picked up a Royal Television Society Programme Award in the Limited Series and Single Drama category, beating off competition for Mr. Bates versus the Post Office and Breathtaking. It also took home 3 awards from the RTS Midlands Awards in November.
Drought has been declared across the West Midlands, including Coventry and Warwickshire. Such is the situation in parts of England that the Environment Agency called a national drought group to discuss the current water shortfall situation, now defined as a nationally significant incident. Drought has been officially declared in the West Midlands, East Midlands, Yorkshire, Cumbria and Lancashire, Greater Manchester, Merseyside and Cheshire. There are 6 more experiencing prolonged dry weather following the driest 6 months to July since 1976. Despite some rain, the government has said that many river flows and reservoir levels in England continue to recede compared to June. Currently, Severn Trent Water, which provides water across our region, has not put any water bans in place. But Yorkshire Water has put a temporary usage ban, known as a hosepipe ban, in place for all its customers. Thames, South East Water and Southern Water also have postcode-specific bans. The National Drought Group, which includes the Met Office, government, regulators, water companies, the National Farmers Union, Canal and River Trust, anglers and conservation experts, use the meeting to highlight the water-saving measures each sector is taking. Helen Wakeham, the Environment Agency's Director of Water and the National Drought Group Chair, said, "The current situation is nationally significant, and we are calling on everyone to play their part and help reduce the pressure on our water environment. Water companies must continue to quickly fix leaks and lead the way in saving water. We know the challenges farmers are facing and will continue to work with them, other land users and businesses, to ensure everyone acts sustainably. We are grateful to the public for following the restrictions where in place to conserve water in these dry conditions. Simple everyday choices such as turning off a tap also really helps the collective effort to reduce demand and help preserve the health of our rivers and wildlife."
An iconic Coventry shop, established 185 years ago, will soon be closing for good. Charles Ager, which has been selling quality shoes since 1840, stands proudly on Corporation Street, having relocated from Smithford Way just after World War II. But after nearly two centuries in the city, the retailer will be closing for the final time on Friday, August the 22nd. Owner Chris Hart said, "It's really heartbreaking. It's just very sad. When we closed the kids section down, everyone thought we'd closed anyway, so it went very quiet. Unfortunately, this is all a sign of the times. Coventry is not what it used to be. We're the only retail shop left in Corporation Street, and the internet is the biggest killer." Chris said that shopping habits had drastically changed. When he first started 37 years ago, people depended solely on in-store shopping. He said, "People shop in different ways now. Years ago, people used to come in, get their kids' feet measured, and if they'd grown, they'd buy a new pair. But nowadays, they don't even bother coming to get measured. They just buy shoes off the shelf." In 2008, Chris said they sold about 27,000 pairs of kids' shoes, but yearly sales had now dropped to just 3,000. Selling higher-end footwear has also been extremely challenging. One example was a woman who purchased a £60 pair of sandals at the Coventry Charles Ager. Chris said she was the only person to have purchased that particular item in the city. On top of falling sales, national insurance costs and rising wages have placed extra strain on the business, with Chris saying, "We just cannot afford to do it anymore." But he confirmed that the family name would stay alive, with Charles Ager stores still operating on Talisman Square in Kenilworth and the High Street in Swadlincote. He said he was sad to be closing on Corporation Street, but thanked customers for their loyalty over the years, adding, "In some ways, I feel we've actually let them down by moving out." But he'll be leasing the pub, the building, to Chocoberry, which was founded in Leicester in 2018 by Kashif and Atif Razak. This hugely popular cafe chain has existing branches in Derby, London and Cardiff, and now one in Coventry.
Hundreds of people have signed an online petition against an application submitted to Coventry City Council's planning portal, which could see 350 homes built on what's been described as one of Coventry's finest countryside views. The application submitted last month is for land off Kersley's Fivefield Road and would include what is known as Hounds Hill, the city's highest natural viewpoint. It is currently an outline major planning permission submission, which outlines general details for permission, with the finer detail to be approved further down the line. As well as the erection of up to 350 homes, it also includes creation of associated vehicular and pedestrian stroke cycle access, ecological enhancements, highway improvements, parking, landscaping, drainage features, open space, and a series of other changes. But the plan has been met with concern by locals, and a petition has been filed with the City Council. So far, it has just under 300 signatures. It is set to run until the 12th of September. The petition states, "We, the undersigned, petition the Council to register our objections to the planning application of a proposal for 350 houses on one of Coventry's most treasured greenfield sites. This land connects ancient woodlands, supports protected wildlife like skylarks and badgers, and contains a designated strategic viewpoint, the highest in the city, offering some of Coventry's finest countryside views, which would be completely lost. The proposed development would further increase flood risk in the area, put crippling pressure on already overstretched roads, schools and local infrastructure, and permanently destroy one of the most biodiverse and beautiful landscapes in the region."
For a third time, the UK's biggest road cycling race will visit Warwickshire, starting on the 5th of September. The 2025 Lloyd's Tour of Britain could write a new chapter for tourism in the county, a council leader has said. Cyclists will begin the race in Atherston town centre before travelling 116 miles through the county's five districts and finishing with three 700 metre climbs at Burton Dassett Hills Country Park. George Finch, leader of Warwickshire City Council, said having the tour is a massive coup. "What a thrill to see some of the world's finest riders race through Warwickshire's stunning countryside, showcasing the county's intriguing history, heritage and many points of interest along the way. Warwickshire," he said, "is famed internationally for its medieval castles, picturesque market towns and for being the birthplace of celebrated authors William Shakespeare and George Eliot. We want this cycling event to write a new chapter in the story of Warwickshire and to spotlight parts of the county that might not be so well known to people from other parts of the UK, nor indeed the world," he added. The tour starts in Suffolk on the 2nd of September and concludes 5 days later in Cardiff in homage to former Tour de France winner and two-time Olympic champion Geraint Thomas, who will retire after the race. The stage in Warwickshire will pass through North Warwickshire, Nuneaton, Rugby, Stratford and Warwick. Darren Tosh, Operations and Marketing Director at Warwickshire's touring board Shakespeare's England, said, "While hosting such a prestigious event will provide an added boost to tourism businesses, the legacy of the tour visit here will extend well beyond the finish line, as it has so much potential to inspire others to explore our beautiful county by bike, while supporting our long-term commitment to encouraging sustainable travel."
A Coventry chippy with the best batter around has scooped a top award. Satty and Mandy Thandy were left stunned when the name of their shop, St George's Place, obviously spelt P-L-A-I-C-E, scooped the title of Best Fish and Chip Shop in Coventry and Warwickshire at the England's Business Awards. "My wife burst into tears," Satty said, "and I just couldn't believe it. I was lost for words, to be fair. I just didn't know what to say. I was over the moon." It was not the first award the couple have won. 2 years ago, they won the 2023 Blue Ribbon Good Food Award. "We won the Blue Ribbon before, but this one, the England's Business Award, is much bigger." The couple took over the Canley Chippy 6 years ago, having previously run a convenience store. With no experience in the fish and chips industry, they have built up their large customer base, which spreads across Coventry and into Kenilworth and Leamington. They were nominated and voted for by their loyal customers. "The customers said we deserved it. They said they knew we were going to win it, because since we have had the shop, we have turned it around, and our reviews speak for themselves," Satty said. Firstly, I thought it was going to be too hard, as there were so many shops that had entered, but my wife just said, let's just go and make a day out of it. It was a black tie event in Birmingham. So off we went, and when they read out George's place, we couldn't believe it. He explained that the customers have particular favourites. Fish and chips, he said, obviously. Our batter is totally different to most fish and chip shops. They, the customers, say it is the best around. Also kebabs. We are always really busy with our kebabs. When we first started, we had lots on the menu, but we reduced it because we were so busy on the traditional fish and chips, we want to focus on that. Now, with the award and certificate taking pride of place at their Charter Avenue-based chippy, the couple have been buoyed to take their winning streak nationwide. We'd like to go for a national award now. That would be great, Satty said.
A new soundtrack has started to rumble across Britain's green and pleasant pastures. Once punctuated with birdsong and the growl of a tractor's engine, parts of the country's farmland, including Warwickshire, now have a slightly funkier soundtrack. A number of local dairy farmers have started to play music, or moosic, thank you, Elaine, to their cattle in a bid to improve the cattle's welfare and, quite possibly, the quality of their produce. Charles Godby, a dairy farmer based in Nuneaton, has embraced the new trend and has told people why playing music to cows could benefit the wider public. Mr. Godby said he first started playing radio to his cows nearly a decade ago. We installed a robotic milking system, and there was a lot of new harsh sounds and noises from it. So we wanted to drown that out and give them a constant sound. So about 10 years ago, somebody suggested the cows like classical music. That was the trend back then. So I put on a classical radio station for the cows to listen to, and it just helps them relax a little bit. Jazz music, however, with recent success on TikTok bringing the fad to the fore, is the current flavour. Mr. Godby said he's tried a number of different genres and radio stations over the years. He initially started to play his herd music simply to calm them, but it is thought that the music can help milk production too. The farmer said that the theory behind the Pavlov's dog experiment could also mean that music makes cows physically and mentally prepared to be milked. In the famous experiment, Pavlov's dogs were conditioned to associate the noise of a bell with receiving food. We always have music on in the milking parlour, Mr. Godby said, and not just for the staff to listen to. It's a little bit like the Pavlov dog theory, where it's waking up the senses. It helps relax the cows and the workers, so that's a win-win all round. For Mr. Godby, the music craze first started with farmers playing classical music, as we said. But the latest trend with jazz on the menu at farms across the UK, he said that cows probably would respond to any kind of music. I think, in fact, if you went and stood on the edge of the field, like you see on these TikTok accounts, and put any music on the cows had come across, they just want to be nosy and see what's going on. And I think as long as you're not doing anything startling, they're going to come over and want to have a look. But this music trend has this calming and productive effect, which we think is beneficial to all.
Tins of Tom Piper Christmas pudding and an old aero bar are among items destined for the bin as part of Coventry City's archive clear out. Culture Coventry Trust, which organises the city's arts collections, is also set to destroy tins of Heinz treacle sponge and National Household dried skimmed milk. These food items are considered a risk to health and safety and contamination of the collection, according to the report to the City Council. They make up just a small percentage of nearly 600 things on a list of items to be moved on, some of which will be offered to museums in other parts of the country. The majority are in Coventry Transport Museum, the Herbert Art Gallery and Museum, and storerooms. Vintage camera equipment and old tools from Coventry shops are also set to go, together with a selection of ceramics, including commemorative plates. The report explains that a planned large-scale move of collections to the City Centre Culture Gateway, which will be housed in the former IKEA building, prompted the review. The Trust Board has also approved the disposal of 588 items and small collections, but the Council also needs to agree. The Trust confirmed it was legally entitled to dispose of the items and any agreements made with donors would be taken into account. The report said priority would be given to retaining items within the public domain, with museums offered first refusal. Proceeds from any sales would be held in reserves by Culture Coventry Trust and either reinstated in further acquisitions or used for improvements to existing collections.
Outlook News.
Hugh is still on holiday, but I'm delighted to say we've got the world-famous showdown champion, Chris, with us for an update from the Hub.
Well, hello, listeners. It is me again. I had some praise this week. I love a bit of praise, me. Nice bit of ego swelling. Does me the world of good. A couple of people said how my address last week sounded very excitable and very happy. So, you know, I'm just glad that it's working and that, you know, my coffee subscription isn't going to waste. Okay, so on to this week's notices, which I am making up as we go on. As I go along, whatever, making them up. Flying by the seat of my pants, as they say in Hamilton. So, there's a couple of spaces left on the boat trip on the 31st of this month, August. So, if anybody's interested in getting a last-minute entry, let us know. I think it's £20 each, and that includes the bus to and from. It includes the boat trip. And that's about all it includes. You have to bring your own food. But that's fine because, you know, boat snacks are the best kind of snacks. Or any road snacks, even if the road is covered in 6 foot of very murky water. Probably not 6 foot, is it really? Probably being generous. Anywho, other things going on. I mean, it's hot at the minute. Like, make sure you're drinking lots of water. That's, you know, that's health advice from the Hub, that is. Maybe that should be a whole new... No, it shouldn't be a whole new section, should it? Because I'll just bore everyone to tears. 9th of October, the World Sight Day thing. Any ideas on that? Let us know, because we want to make it an event that you guys enjoy and that other people around will enjoy, and make it a great day. There's already some interesting things afoot, so yeah, keep them coming. I think that's about it. There's not very much going on at the minute. It's far too hot for anything to be going on, really. So, yeah, I hope you're all staying cool, staying well, staying happy. That's the most important, really. Just be happy. It doesn't matter about anything else, does it? As long as you're feeling chipper and cheerful. I hope you all have a wonderful week, and you'll probably hear... do you know what? I'm going to bully Hugh into doing this next week, and then we're going to have a competition and see who gets the most praise. Yeah! So, you know, if anyone wants to tell us how wonderful we're doing, then, you know, just let us know. Particularly if it's me. If it's Hugh, don't tell him. He doesn't need to know. He's been on holiday. Serves him right. It's been about 2 weeks. Sent me a picture yesterday, actually. Well, he didn't send me a picture, sorry. He sent me an email saying, if I were to send you a picture, the alt text would say... what was it? Oh, it was really hard to say. It was something like... two brightly bronzed Brits languishing languidly in the shadow of a cafe drinking Dom Perrier or some French word for shandy, which sounded wonderful. And then a coat for the boy, because, yeah, Dennis is only 16, so he doesn't get shandy. And, yeah, I thought, well, do you know what? I would feel guilty, except it was 30-odd degrees, so... really, I had a great time. It was nice and warm here too, so there, I don't need no French shandy, because I can have nice, I can have whatever I want, really. Talking of which, right, there's a really nice, if you like alcohol free beer, there's a really nice beer, right? It's called Cloudwater, is the company that make it. They do a really tangy lemon one. It's like adult lemonade. It's absolutely wonderful. I highly recommend it to anyone who hasn't tried it. It doesn't taste particularly beery, which is probably why I like it. But it does taste very lemony, which I very much enjoy. Right, that's enough waffle from me. thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much to the Talking Newspaper thing for talking newspapers. And I can hear everything they're doing for the wall because they've got some level problems, I think, this week. So the news was absolutely booming out over the campus. It was great. That's about it, really. Oh, yeah, Carl is back this week, actually. That's of importance. He's having the day off today, Wednesday. And fake Carl, as we've started to call him, real Frank, has been taking the hot seat and doing the bus stuff while Carl and Sylvia spend lots of time with their grandson. So, yeah, he's back again tomorrow, I do believe. There are lots of lovely things in the charity shops. If anybody fancies coming and spending lots of money, please do, because it's wonderful. And the great thing about our charity shop, right, is all the staff are really nice. So if you can't see what you're buying, A, they're more than happy for you to go around and feel. B, they'll take you around and help you feel and find the right stuff you want. And C, if you do buy something, they'll make sure it looks good and they won't send you away looking like a fool. Well, at least that's what I'm told. Maybe I do look a fool and no one's told me yet. I don't know. But I'm pretty confident that the staff there are wonderful and doing the business. So, yeah, come and shop at CVH. Great place to be. Have fun. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Chris. Now here's Sarah with her take on the week's sport.
Well, hello there, lovely, 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 lovely listeners. You can tell I'm happy. Well, football's back. Anyway, welcome to probably a slightly shorter sport. On today's menu, or me and you, as Mum used to sarcastically call it, we have football, tennis, and a little bit of rugby union. But I'm afraid the F1 Grand Prix season's taking a break. Golf, all of the majors are over. The Diamond League Athletics is having a week off. And cricket is now taking place in a format I don't fully understand and by names that don't mean anything. You know, they're not counties. So I decided that I shall report or bring to you results of test matches, men's and women's, home and away, and any highlights of T20 internationals. Is that okay? Right, I think we have an understanding. Now on to the mighty Sky Blues. Well, after a drought of 89 days, can't believe it's 89 days since that fateful goal went in, scored by Sunderland in extra time to take them to Wembley and not us. But anyway, it has been 89 days. But football is back. I mean, it's been back for the lower league teams, even League Division 1 and 2 for a week or so, but the Championship is back. The Premier's got to wait a couple more weeks. But there's been a lot of hype about our season's opening. Oh, it should be a fairly easy run. We've got Hull City, who were nearly relegated last season, as our openers. Then we go to Derby, who last season were also in the relegation hunt. Then we entertain QPR, who again were in the relegation zone for so long. Well, anyway, before I go on to that, we have a new crew at CWR. So you'll probably hear me crediting either Lorna Bailey, who now chairs the programme, Rob Gurney, who is back as the match day manager, well, the match day commentator, and ably assisted by Steve Grizovic, the long-term and FA Cup winning goalie for City and then goalie coach for many, many years. And actually, talking about goalies, I'm pleased to see that although it's the beginning of the season, I recognise most of the names in our team. The big change, and he played the whole match, was that we have a 24-year-old goalie on loan from Premier League Brighton, Carl Rushford. We do have two other new signings, including a Spaniard. Both were on the bench, and in fact, the one, Mr. Miguel, I'll give you his double-barreled surname next week. All things come to those who wait. Teacher has talked. He came on halfway through the second half. But it was great to see that at the moment we're still holding on to Jack Redoni and Van Avac, although they are strongly rumoured to be being hunted by Premier Leagues for quite a few million pounds. But I suppose this stability is indicative of us having a stable owner, not an owner who owns stables, you know what I mean. Whereas in the past, when we had the hedge hunting firm Sisu, they were just out for a quick buck. So, let's start the match. Well, I'll be honest, the match can best be summed up as 98 minutes of my life, which I'll never get back. 0-0 at half-time and 0-0 at full-time, despite 8 minutes extra time. I would not exactly say it was riveting. The most frustrating thing was that we have a good defence, even Oggie said that, which is a change. And we have quite a strong midfield, although they were opened up a couple of times. And they were doing great things at passing to our two strikers, Thomas Brandon Asante and Jack Redoni, and Ellis Sims when he was substituted on. But they just couldn't find that net, and it was so frustrating. Oh, City, we do love you, but... Anyway, they've got a match in the EFL Cup, which I think is still called the Carabao, but it could be the Milk Cup or the League Cup, who knows. Anyway, it's the second-rated cup on Tuesday, but that's the Tuesday just gone, so I'll bring you a summary next week. Then next Saturday, that is the 16th, they've got a kick. They're playing Derby away at Pride Park. But if you're going to listen to it, it is a 12:30 kick-off again. Come on, City, please keep us awake this time. Now, City, as you know, play in the Championship, which is Football League 2, down in Tier 6. Actually, it's called the Southern Premier League. We have Leamington, they drew away to Burton Ashton. Not a bad result there, Leamington. But I'm afraid Stratford, down in Tier 7, were thumped 3-0 by Banbury United. We did have a lot of good results in the lowest leagues, 8 and 9. And I would particularly like to highlight Nuneaton Town, who have now won 3 out of 3 matches. Looking good, Nuneaton. And now on to tennis. Having finished with the Canadian Open, they've all flown down to Cincinnati. Well, to be honest, most of the Brits needn't have bothered, because thus far, and I'm recording actually on Sunday morning before my hay fever kicks in, we have lost Katie Bolter, Sonny Cartel, and Jacob Fernley. In fact, the only winner thus far, drumroll, and into the second round, drumroll, is Emma Raducanu, who has got a new coach. I've lost track. Well, no, I haven't actually. That's her 8th since she won the US Open. And I'm not including Mark Petchy, who was more of an advisor. Anyway, the interesting thing about this coach is that he was Rafa Nadal's coach. Now, I'm not going to attempt to pronounce his name till I've heard it several times, but I'm spelling it R-O-I-G, Roig, or something like that. And just quickly to report on rugby union, it's all going frighteningly well for our women's rugby union side, with the World Cup about to start. And when I say about, I mean August 22nd. they now haven't lost in 27 matches. That is a running streak of 1,001 days. And they won their final warm-up match before the World Cup by thrashing France 40-6. And finally, now I happened to be listening to Radio 5 Live yesterday after the football had finished, because they were doing a sort of look back at what was going on in the world of football. And they were giving out the championship results, and then they came to Stoke City, which of course is a team now managed by Mark Robins, our much missed and beloved manager, though Frank's doing a pretty damn good job. And Stoke had pulled off a 3-1 win, scoring 2 goals in extra time. And they said, oh yes, Mark is really good at doing that and galvanising the team. And the way he's building up the fan base at Stoke, it's incredible. But I mean, the things he did at Coventry, I remember that for a lot of people, hearing the news that Mark Robins was leaving was like a Princess Diana moment. To which his colleague says, Princess Diana moment? Yes, the other man said. Everyone can remember where they were when they heard the news that Mark Robins was leaving. Well, that is a great high esteem comparison, though I would actually substitute Princess Diana for Queen Elizabeth II or Freddie Mercury, but that's just my preferences. Anyway, lovely listeners, before I get myself into any more trouble, I better say bye-bye and enjoy, well, hope you can make the best of the warm weather. Keep drinking and put on that sunscreen when you go out. Bye!
Looking good for our rugby union team. 1,001 days unbeaten. Gosh, that's something Coventry City can only dream of. And now here's Dave with your postbag for the week.
This is Postbag. Join in the discussion.
Hello there, and welcome to your postbag again this week. Please tell us what you've been doing lately. It's a chat forum postbag that's been going long before smartphones and social media, and a lot safer too. So just talk to us, you'd be alright, or send us a letter. Anyway, how's your gardening? Tell us about any gardening tips that help you in the garden, like contrast, for instance. It's been a bit windy lately. I've been trying to grow sunflowers. Now, one was towering above me, and I was looking forward to it blooming with a huge flower the size of a dinner plate. Unfortunately, I couldn't find a ball of string one morning with a view to tie it to a cane to stop it blowing over, so I hoped to buy another one later in the day. But when I came home, the sunflower had blown over and snapped, so I had to chop it up and bin it. So there's a poem, for want of a nail, the horse was lost. Eventually, the battle was lost, all for the want of a horseshoe nail. So there you are. Do you have any tips about finding things around the house? Do you have some kind of system? Anyway, let us know. For now, Graham starts it off this week with some important information about bus changes.
Well, I always check the signs in Poor Meadow at the head of the stand. They're tactile, they're in braille. And I don't expect any changes, but it gives me a good excuse just to nip round the corner and plonk myself at the head of the queue. Except last night when I checked the sign, things were not as usual. There was a different service departing from that stand. I haven't heard any publicity about it. But I did stop a passerby who turned out to be a bus driver. She was aware there'd been changes, but they'd not told anything. But she did go and have a look at the display screen and told me that my bus, which I needed, which was Service 8 to Horsley Park, had been moved to Stand J, which is just to the right of the building in the middle of Palmetto, just round the corner from the X1, not too far away from other Holyhead Road services, so it makes sense, I suppose. And Service 7 and 7A to Bell Green now depart from Stand Q. I'm not aware of any other changes, but it is always a good idea to check those signs at the head of the queue. They are accessible, there's no excuse. And because they don't seem to tell us when they make these changes, and I'd hate anybody to get on the wrong bus.
Thank you very much, Graham, for your helpful information. Once again, the Service 8 to Horsley Park now leaves from Stand J, and the 7 and 7A to Bell Green leaves from Stand Q. I landed at Stand Q the other day from Cowden, and from Palmetto to Cowden, though, it's still Stand G. Now we welcome back Julia, with the report entitled "The Darling Buds of May." We are all behind, like the vicar's wife, at the moment. Anyway, we had a torch meeting at the end of May in the church. Nigel introduced us all, and it was Lee and John's birthday, so we gave them the bumps. Andy read out poems. He's an actor, author and plumber, but he doesn't do them all at once. He's been in EastEnders and played Richard III, but not in EastEnders. He read out a Shakespearean sonnet to Peggy. Did you know that Shakespeare was born on the 23rd of April and died on the same day? So he didn't hang around, did he? It's a wonder that he was able to write all those plays. Our Edwina was born on the 23rd of April too, but not in 1616. She's a writer too. We finished torch with, can you guess? That's right, tea and cakes. Love from Julia. Thank you, Julia. Well, Elizabeth went to the last torch meeting and she really enjoyed it. The Coventry branch of Torch Fellowship meets on the last Saturday of the month at Earlston Methodist Church between 2 and 4pm. Thank you, Julia. Talking of Richard III, our eldest son Paul told me that there was a camping shop in York with an advert in the window that read, "Now is the winter of our discount tents." Thought that was quite good. Have you been to the Richard III exhibition in Leicester, where they found him under a car park? Or have you been to Bosworth Fields, where the battle took place? Do you think he was a saint or sinner, or a bit of both? Because he was suspected of having his nephews murdered in the Tower of London. And Julia, former EastEnders actor, knitting Ganantra's family corner shop, is near where you live, Julia. And he's been known to help in his family's corner shop from time to time when he's in Coventry. Talking of Edwina, she mentioned recently that she was unable to go to the Coventry Vision Hub Summer Fete, as she and a carer met up with an old friend, Janet, at a garden centre. This week she tells you about the Quarry Garden at the top of the car park at Russell's Garden Centre.
Hi everybody, it's Edwina. I've just been chatting with David, and David was telling me that the Monday Club had actually been to the Russell's Garden Centre on one of their days out. I explained to him that there is very much more to Russell's than just the part where you wander around and look at the plants and buy. There is a very, very large part of it. After you go past the cafe, you can wander around when the azaleas, the rhododendron and all the beautiful shrubs are all in full flower. You wander onto this hill and you follow the path. And you're touching rhododendrons and azaleas and other plants that have been put ground-wise and really enjoying suddenly seeing something different. On one side, there was a beautiful pond with trees round, which was very welcome shade if it's a hot day. And we sat for a while. It was one of the volunteers, Diana, that took me to this particular part. It's quite hidden, really, but we wandered following the path and enjoying the wonderful colours of all these plants and bushes. And suddenly, you look into the distance and you see a lake, and you can see the shining water on the lake. It's a beautiful scene. When you reach that part, you are wandering the path and doing a U-turn and returning on the other side. And once again, you have some surprises. One of the surprises, as we neared the last entrance to go back to the shopping part of the garden centre, there was a beautiful silver birch tree. Silver birch trees are my favourite. This one was indeed a very old, gnarled tree. I went over and felt all of it.
Thank you, Edwina. The best time to visit the quarry garden is when the azaleas are out in May. It's not really wheelchair friendly as it's up and down hills. And back to Graham, he tells you about a price rise on National Express.
Bad news if you travel on National Express buses before 9:30 in the morning and you use a old person's bus pass or a disabled person's travel card. It's been £1.50 for some time if you have a concession card. And when they last put the prices up, nothing was said about the pre-9:30. They never do mention that, actually. But I've just found out it's gone up to £2 now. So if you travel before 9:30 with a concession card, then it's gone up to £2 on National Express buses. Well, it wouldn't last forever, would it?
Thank you, Graham, for that information, just to make sure we got the right change, or however you can pay. But that's all we got in Postbag this week. The quantity of Postbag really depends on you filling the space, which is flexible. There's plenty of room for you. You can ring up on that phone number, 02476 717 522, and press 5 for Coventry Talking Newspaper. You can send us an email, postbag@talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Or you can send a message to my email if you want, davidmonks46@gmail.com. Now, okay, or you can send us a letter, either written by you or someone on your behalf. Okay, right. There are plenty of ways you can send messages to Postbag, and it's really worthwhile doing it as well. So, and don't forget to start ordering hand-crocheted poppies from Julia. That's £1.50 for single or double poppies, or glitter or non-glitter. Please state which ones you want, but please order some and give us some encouragement. The money is split between two good causes: Coventry Vision Hub, that helps you, and Royal British Legion. So contact her in any way you can, including via Postbag. So let's hear from you next time. Have you been on holiday, for instance? Tell us all about it. Okay, thank you very much, and bye for now.
This is Outlook. You can contact Postbag.
Our website is www.talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Our email address is postbag@talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Join in the discussion on Postbag.
Thanks to Dave for this week's Postbag, and a big thank you to you for all your contributions. Now here's Elaine to tell us about the village of Mansetta in North Warwickshire.
Mansetta is situated on a rocky outcrop overlooking the valley of the River Anker. The name Mansetta comes from the Roman Manduessedum. This was a Roman camp on the slight rise on which the church now stands. It was one of a line of forts built as the Romans advanced northwards, the A5 Watling Street marking the frontier. William the Conqueror granted the manor of Mansetta to his nephew, the Earl of Chester, who bestowed it on a Norman knight. He assumed the name of Mansester and built the church and manor house. Mansetta Manor was a 14th century house of massive oak framing. Extensions and additions to the front now make it look like a half-timbered gabled house of the Tudor period. Here lived the Mansetta martyr, Robert Glover, and his brothers John and William. They were active Protestants at a time when Mary Tudor was trying to impose Catholicism on England. Robert, ill in bed at the time, was arrested and burnt at the stake in Coventry in 1555. John and William escaped, but died of starvation. A neighbour, Mrs. Lewis, also a Protestant, was hidden in a little room off the main bedroom in Manor Farm, but she was eventually burnt at the stake in Lichfield in 1557. There are secret panels in the manor and a secret passage from Mansetta to Merivale. In the late 1900s, the manor became a hotel and restaurant, but it has now closed and is a private home. Between the manor and the church are a row of almshouses, which along with another row opposite the church were built in 1728 and endowed from the money of £2,000 left by James Graymer, a London goldsmith of Atherstone descent. Guy de Mansetta started building the first part of the church tower in the 14th century, but he died in 1365 before it was completed in the 15th century. The north aisle of the church was the chapel of the Bracebridges of Atherstone. The south aisle was the chantry of the convent of Merivale. The east window contains fine stained glass and is thought to have been part of the great Jesse window from Merivale Abbey. Part of this window was made by John Thornton, builder of the great east window of York Minster. The bells in the tower and the east window have recently been restored. As trade developed in Norman times, so the town of Atherstone gradually grew in size, and the importance of the village of Mansetta slowly diminished, although the church of Mansetta still remained the mother church. The dame's school was in a cottage where scholars were charged 2 pence per week. The next school was built in 1875 with one room only, and additions were made as the number of children increased. Unfortunately, the village school closed in the 1990s and is now a private house. The church and the memorial hall are the present centres of activity. There are only 2 pubs in the village. The 14th century Plough Inn was next to the church, and one of the cottages adjacent to it was thought to be the Guild House, set up by the Abbot of Merivale. The Blue Boar Inn was a small place near the smithy and the old arbour cottages. The old mill, now in ruins, was down by the River Anker just below the church. The local scouts have built a new headquarters in this lane, and the prefabricated council houses in the village have been demolished and replaced with brick ones. The lovely countryside around Mansetta was part of the Arden Forest, and by 1779 there were 5 mixed farms in the area. Many of the fields around the village are now housing estates with a large recreational ground, although part of the outwoods is now a golf course, and there is limited access to the Bluebell Woods and the reservoir. The retaining dam of the reservoir was lined with stone from the Manchester Quarry, started in the 19th century. Two quarries merged in 1951, but part of this industry is now closed, as has the last hatting factory in Atherston in 1999, and there are no longer any mining pits in the area. The canal was used to transport coal and quarry stone, but today is only used for leisure activities. The A5 takes traffic across the River Anker and along the bypass, skirting Mansetta and Atherston. Local people now work in light industries on the three industrial sites within a 2-mile radius of the village, but many also travel to the larger towns such as Tamworth, Nuneaton, Hinckley, Coventry and Birmingham.
Next week we'll hear about the village of Morton. Now, the second part of the feature about the concerns that palm trees may be helping the spread of fires in California. This is written by Peter Sheridan from the Daily Express and is read by Bill.
And as January's wildfires proved, blazing palm trees can be deadly. Ironically, not a single palm is native to Los Angeles, which was once a mix of chaparral, grasslands and oaks. The first palms were introduced from Mexico and South America by Spanish missionaries in the late 1700s, supposedly to supply palm fronds to celebrate Palm Sunday and evoke biblical lands at their mission churches. A century later, developers planted palm trees to entice Americans to move west to a land of balmy sunshine, evoking the relaxed ambiance of tropical desert isles. With time, the palms came to personify Los Angeles itself, fecund, exotic, and an oasis in the California desert. The tall Mexican fan palm predominates today, looking like a fuzzy giant spider stuck atop a pole. But there are more than 100 species around Los Angeles, including the lush Canary Island date palms, beloved by Beverly Hills mansions, queen palms and windmill palms. But these trees can grow so high they become hard to maintain, and as dead fronds accumulate in a petticoat beneath the tree crowns, they become a fire hazard. Fronds swaying in the breeze can touch electricity lines, sparking blazes. We understand that people living in Southern California love their palms, but since fire season is year-round, they can be a danger to the public, says arborist Tavita Faausu of the Los Angeles Electric Company, Southern California Edison. Dead palm fronds can also be carried by high winds and travel long distances, possibly hitting power lines along the way and starting fires. The company moved more than 11,000 palm trees from hazardous locations in recent years, and following this year's wildfires, more palms are now targeted for destruction. For all their beauty, palm trees often serve as nests for legions of disease-carrying rats, drop heavy fronds without warning on passers-by, and can be dangerous to trim. Gardeners are routinely crushed to death by compressed falling fronds or electrocuted while pruning the trees. Palm trees also suck up water but provide little shade, which makes them less desirable as global warming sends temperatures soaring. We don't have unlimited space or water, says Los Angeles City Forest Officer Rachel Mullerish, who advocates planting only the biggest and heaviest hitters when it comes to habitat and cooling. In recent years, the city has replaced dead palms with fire-resistant shade trees, such as oaks, sycamores, and fig. There are definitely fewer palm trees being planted today than there were even 20 or 30 years ago, says University of Southern California professor and landscape architect Esther Margulies. Palm trees have also been decimated in recent years by mass infestations of an invasive weevil, a type of beetle, and a fatal fungal disease, adding to the masses of dead wood ready to ignite at the slightest spark. But some palms can live up to 200 years, and so even with mass removals, they will not vanish from the Los Angeles skyline overnight. And many residents would hate to see the palm trees disappear forever. People would regret getting rid of all the palm trees, says Professor Stephanie Pinstel at the Institute of the Environment and Sustainability at the University of California. I think there would be a kind of nostalgia. And Angelenos are hesitant to see their city's leafy emblem eradicated. Customers have proven very resistant to removals, confessed a Southern Californian Edison spokesman. The people of Los Angeles love to see their palm trees swaying in the cerulean sky and silhouetted against a sunset, even if it kills them.
And now part one of a remarkable story about a women's orchestra in Auschwitz and how their lives depended on how well they performed. It's taken from a book by Anne Seber and is read by Margaret.
Playing the cello saved Anita Lasker's life. Deported to the concentration camp at Auschwitz in December 1943, aged 18, she, like all its prisoners, found her head being shaved, her clothes stripped off, and a number tattooed on her arm. A young woman who was taking away her shoes bombarded her with questions. Lasker remarked that she played the cello. The response, "That is fantastic, you will be saved." Soon, to her own amazement, Lasker was a member of something completely unexpected in such a context, an orchestra. This spring marks the 80th anniversary of the end of the Second World War, and the legacies of the Holocaust are much in the spotlight. Lasker, married name Lasker Wolfish, who is 99, was recently featured in BBC TV documentary The Last Musician of Auschwitz. Now the biographer Anne Seber has turned her attention to the entire women's orchestra in an extraordinary account of survival against all the odds. The orchestra was the brainchild of an ambitious camp overseer, Maria Mandel, who intended it to increase her authority and influence in the hierarchy. The incarcerated musicians were required to play marches while their fellow prisoners were herded out to hard labour in the mornings and when they returned at night. They were also summoned to perform at functions held by Nazi dignitaries and occasionally for individuals. Lasker once had to play Schumann's poetic Traumerei, Dreaming, for Josef Mengele, notorious for his sadistic medical experiments. Nevertheless, being in the orchestra helped many of these young women stay alive. What made Seber take up this harrowing story? Now 73, she is renowned for her biographies of strong women of the 19th and 20th centuries, including Wallis Simpson and Jenny Churchill, the American mother of Winston. Her motivation for this book, however, was personal. Seber's father, Major Eric Rubinstein, had been in the British Army and was involved in dismantling the liberated Bergen-Belsen concentration camp in spring 1945. "I had known that he had been at Belsen," Seber says, "but he never talked about it." she discovered his role only by visiting the National Archives. I found his army record. At Belsen, he was in charge of setting fire to the louse-ridden huts. Bergen-Belsen was where many of the women's orchestra had ended up. Seba reckons her father's path had crossed that of their survivors. They gave a Red Cross concert on the 24th of May. That was a day that my father put in his war diary. He was responsible for procurement, met chiefly of food and clothes. It would have also been his job to seek a cello for Lasker. Clearly he wasn't able to get one. Anita wasn't in that concert because she had no instrument, Seba recounts. But discovering that my father was there at that moment then led me into the backstory of Auschwitz.
Margaret will be back with the second part next week, but now here's Nigel with advice to gardeners on how to look after your plants at this time of year. They'll need lots of water, I would imagine.
Now we're into high summer, or supposedly into that, according to the months of the year, it's time to look at things to do in the garden, which are essential. Firstly, of course, you need to keep your lawn trimmed, and also, depending on the rain and sun, how fast it grows will determine how often you have to mow it. Containers, of course, in your garden, if you've got plants around patios, dry out very quickly with the hot sun we had in July, and so they do need watering very regularly, probably even as much as once every day. It's now, of course, high rose season. They are coming into bloom, and so to help them along, it won't be harmful at all to add some little rose fertilisers to get better blooms and stronger plants. Also, of course, your borders, which have been watered maybe, will need a little feed to help them along as well and keep them to fine fettle and good flowering. If you've got sweet peas, don't forget when they've finished, pull them out. We don't want the seeds going into the ground again. And weeding, of course, while in the hot weather they grow very fast. If it's dry, they might die off, but you need to help them out of the ground in any case so they don't smother your nice plants. Don't forget also to trim back or prune any flower heads that have died off so the new ones can get a good go. Wisteria, at this time of the year, it's finished flowering, it's full of leaves, but it does need pruning, and it's the branches which grow outwards or upwards which need to be taken out. You want to keep the horizontal ones in because those are the ones on which your flowers will develop for next season. Some flowers grow on woody stems, and a typical example is spirea, and they need to be cut back to keep them into a good shape and also for good flowering next year. Both lupins and delphiniums are probably just about over by now, and so you want to take them out and take the whole pattern out of the ground. They'll regrow, and you may even get a few late flowers if you put them in pots. Don't forget also that this time of the year to think about your wildlife in your garden. Create a dust bath and even a water bath for the birds. And don't forget, keep feeding them regularly. I'm surprised how quickly the birds in my garden eat up the peanuts I put out for them. The containers seem to need to be refilled about every 2 days. If you've got a glut of vegetables, don't forget you can give them to your friends rather than let them to rot in the ground. One of the things I haven't seen for a very long time is a hedgehog, but if you've got any around you, they are still breeding in July and August, so remember, if you've got them around you, leave some fresh water out for them so that they are good and healthy. There are lots of little bugs around as well, of course. There are sticky mites, there are little horse beetles, there are grasshoppers, there are spiders. Various things need various different treatments, but on the whole, we haven't had that many insects this year. They've been down dramatically, and I've noticed there are hardly any wasps, They may come around later when the bees have finished for their season. So there's a few tips for you for this high season of summer. Enjoy your garden.
Thanks, Nigel. When it comes to gardening, I need all the advice I can get. Now an article taken from the Coventry Evening Telegraph, where Rosalind Fenton explores the south coast when it's out of season. It's read by Elaine.
Summertime on England's south coast conjures up images of sunny days on golden beaches and towns filled with tourists clutching ice creams. But Christchurch, Poole and Bournemouth, with their Jurassic coastline and idyllic countryside, reveal an entirely different charm when visited out of season. In mid-November, when I took my trip, the normally bustling resorts offered crowd-free tranquility. Plus, there are superb bargains to be found at restaurants and hotels as they look to attract visitors. The entire region's landscape is a geological marvel, but it's not just for fossil hunters. With fewer crowds, the region's treasures, incredible nature reserves, galleries and restaurants become much more inviting. We started in Poole, which is known for its beautiful harbour and busy quay, rather than what is dockside. Look beyond the boats and you'll see the resort is filled with treats, including Poole Museum and adjacent Scaplin's Court, a medieval merchant's house with stunning gardens. It's undergoing a 10.3 redevelopment supported by funding from the Heritage Fund and set to reopen this summer. After my safety training, I donned a high-vis vest and hard hat to explore the site, which will remain free to enter. Situated between the quay and Old Town, the transformation will turn the museum into a community hub, telling the story of the harbour from the Ice Age until now. It will feature incredible artefacts, including an Iron Age logboat and a large collection of Poole pottery. There are also plans to install a 7-metre walrus tusk on the ground floor that will sweep upwards to the top floor. Afterwards, we walk for miles following the numbered cockle plaques. There are 82 in total around the old town, which uncovered Poole's seafaring exploits with sailors and smugglers. Outside the quaint custom house, we learned how a gang of 60 armed smugglers battered down the door to retrieve a lot of contraband tea in 1747. Several were later captured and hanged. Strolling along the quay, we passed a statue of Lord Baden-Powell, founder of the Scouting Movement, who inspired millions worldwide. His saying, "Life without adventure would be deadly dull," aptly sums up the opportunities in Poole. It would be a shame to visit such a seafaring place and not enjoy some of the local cuisine. So we had dinner at Rockfish. Prices for the mains start at £16.95. It offers sustainable fish and chips, so I stuck to the classic, line caught Icelandic haddock and unlimited chips, with a pot of curry sauce on the side, after a huge vat of mussels to start with. My dining partner ordered sardines and an utterly delicious Dover sole. Our base was the Captain's Club in Christchurch, a truly ship-shape boutique hotel, staying in a plush family suite with two bedrooms, a huge kitchen and living room with floor-to-ceiling windows and incredible views of the River Stour. Each morning we enjoyed a lavish breakfast in the family-friendly restaurant. The elegant spa with a hydrotherapy bath is popular. One of the best parts of our trip was exploring Hengistbury Head, an incredible clifftop nature reserve. Standing 118 feet above sea level, the site of special scientific interest offers panoramic views along the coast and across to the Isle of Wight. A popular dog walking spot for locals, archaeologist Dr. Hayden Scott Pratt told us how the reserve has around 12,500 years of continuous human history. On the day we visited, volunteers were working on an Iron Age roundhouse built using traditional tools. The volunteers' passion was infectious as I poked my head inside and found myself transported back thousands of years while locals painted murals on the walls. Volunteer Ildiko showed me the wool they'd sheared from the small herd of sheep on site, which they dye using the reserve's plants. Around 10% of the annual 1.2 million visitors stop inside the visitor centre to learn more about the reserve. So a new walking trail will be launched in time for summer, in a bid to highlight the incredible history and surrounding geological makeup. To warm up afterwards, we visited Russell Coates Gallery in Bournemouth, a beautiful and eccentric Victorian building with a garden overlooking the sea. The manor, created by hotelier Merton Russell Coates for his wife Annie, features lots of treasures, including Art Nouveau tiled ceilings, a terrace offering panoramic sea views, and pre-Raphaelite paintings. It wasn't very busy, which gave us ample time to pause over the cornucopia of treasures the couple had picked up while travelling the world. The quirky home was one of our visit highlights, with the museum continuing to champion the couple's ethos to promote art with an exhibition featuring depictions of Purbeck throughout the 20th century. The next day we took a tour of the cliff-top Highcliffe Castle, built for Lord Charles Stuart de Rothesay in 1836. More of a stately home than a castle, his unimpressed wife hoped it would fall into the sea after first seeing it, but grew to appreciate it. It was rendered derelict after two fires in the 1960s destroyed most of it, but its Gothic Revival architecture has been painstakingly restored. Our guided tour, led by Kelly, included the usually off-limits areas. It's a fascinating chance to learn more about the life of Harry Selfridge, the American-born founder of the department store, who rented it for £5,000 a year while spending his fortune on gambling and women. After the tour, we headed to the tea room for cake and a pot of tea before an amble round the grounds that run down to the beach. An out-of-season South Coast trip gave us the chance to relax in lush, crowd-free surroundings, discover its fascinating past, and take in the sights of its world-famous coastline.
Much further north now, as we hear the second part about Dave and Graham's visit to Scotland.
Well, good morning. So, did you enjoy the haggis for breakfast?
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, good breakfast.
Yeah, really nice, really nice. Yeah, I asked the landlord if he was going to pipe in the haggis with the bagpipes. We said that's pushing it a bit. We're standing at Calder Crooks railway station. Where are we off to?
We're off to Edinburgh.
Fantastic. And here comes our train. So what can you hear, Graham?
I hear the sound of the bagpipes.
Yes, well, here we are in Edinburgh, and there's a wonderful tall Scots memorial to Sir Walter Scott, the author. There's some magnificent buildings here, there really is. And Princess Park.
Do you want to find the bagpiper or not?
Yeah, we'll find the bagpiper. Well, you can hear the bagpiper with the Sir Walter Scott Memorial behind him. Fantastic. Hi. We're really enjoying your bagpipes.
Oh, nice.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yes, do you normally stand by the Walter Scott Memorial?
Well, I stand here and then also at the mound and then sometimes at the Royal Mail outside the High Court. So
yes, great
stuff. It's
as
just
well.
Kind of. We all just kind of rotate.
And it's certainly a beautiful spot to play the bagpipes.
Yeah, you get the castle in the background.
You've got the statue.
And yeah, they're all Edinburgh's nice, so you can't really go wrong anywhere. So.
Thank you. Yeah, it's absolutely beautiful. Right. So what's your name?
Robert.
Robert. And we're going on an Edinburgh tram. So where are we off to now, Graham?
The Royal Yacht Britannia.
The Royal Yacht Britannia. Fantastic. So we're about to walk along the gangplank to the Royal Yacht Britannia now. So what do you have to look out for if you're a child?
There's corgis about the ship, and there's also Royal Yachtsman cleaning the bits of the ships. There's two black signal lights. These to use them to send Morse codes with the ships.
Right, I'm speaking to one of the Royal Yachtsmen. What job do you do here? What's your name, first of all?
Okay, so I'm Paul Powell. On board, I was a radio supervisor on board. Yeah. So I did communications. So
yes.
I was on board from 91 till 97.
Yes.
And thoroughly enjoyed my time on board. I used to manage the communications, so not only the communications that looked after the supplies of, how we got things on board, processes and everything operational. Then we also looked after some of the Royal Communications as well.
Do you have any personal memories of meeting members of the Royal family or what they get up to on the yachts?
Oh, I can't say what they got up to on the yacht. We had the Royals on board quite a lot, so
yeah.
Western Isles was a very good time. That we used to pick them up in cows during Cows Week. And then we would take them round to the Western Isles and drop them off in Aberdeen, where they'd go to Balmoral. But we all knew our roles. We knew what we needed to do, so they could relax more on board and just be themselves, because we left them, we give them their space, we got on with running the ship, and they could relax, and they knew we were at hand if they needed us for anything. So it was good times. Good times. Yeah.
So did you meet any of the members of the Royal Family?
Yes, all of them.
Yeah, all of them. Okay.
Yes.
The Queen.
The Queen. She would also come round and thank us for our time and spice the main race.
Yeah.
King Charles or Prince Charles, as he was then, would come round. So most of them would come round and thank us after a royal visit, and that would come round and thank us for our efforts, really.
Yeah,
so it's good. Yeah, it's good fun. So I'm very fortunate.
So what do we have here, Gwen?
It's a games cabinet. Mm. It's got Scrabble, Monopoly and Cluedo,
And that's in the room where the Queen used to relax and have afternoon tea while looking at the beautiful views through the window at the rear of the yacht. Wow, so here's the Queen's bedroom.
I think that's the bathroom, was it?
Yeah, oh yes, on the right hand side of the bed, the bathroom. And it's a lovely single bed with flowers on. Very nice, and there's a nice dressing room table with pictures of the family on.
Interconnecting door from the Duke of Edinburgh to the Queen's bedroom. They both had their own bathrooms,
Okay, what room have we got now?
The honeymoon suite. It's the only room on board with a double bed.
Okay, so who slept in it?
Prince Charles, I think.
Okay, right. And Diana, presumably. Well, we are in the state dining room now, aren't we, Graham?
Yeah, Mandela, Thatcher, loads of well-known people,
They were all entertained here by the Queen and Prince Philip. A wonderful long table with candelabras on.
Wow!
So where are we now, Graham?
Up on top of Carlton Hill.
How can we are overlooking Edinburgh with a fantastic view all round, and behind us on top of the hill is what's known as the Acropolis of the North. It's a structure with 12 pillars and it resembles the Acropolis in Athens. And there below is a fantastic scape of Edinburgh with all its buildings and houses. And in the opposite direction to the view of Edinburgh, beyond the Acropolis of the North, is an extinct volcano known as Arthur's Seat. Is it time to go back to the hotel now in Caldercrooks?
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. Okay. Well, it's lovely in Edinburgh, it really is. I'm standing by a brass cannon at the moment that's travelled all over the world.
We'll hear the third and final part of the visit to Scotland next week. But now here's Nigel with a little conundrum for us to mull over.
Three fellows go into a restaurant for a quick meal. At the end of the meal, they're presented with a bill for £30, so they each pay £10. The waiter goes away and suddenly realises he's overcharged them by £5. The bill should only have been £25. But the waiter isn't entirely honest, so he decides he'll give them £1 back each and pocket the spare £2 himself. So they've now paid £9 each, £27. So £27 and the £2 the waiter has pocketed is only £29. Where's the extra pound gone to? Think about it. I'll give you some clues next week. In fact, maybe the answer as well. Okay? Good luck.
And Nigel will be back with the answer next week. But that brings us an end to this week's edition of Outlook. So from me and the rest of the team, it's goodbye for another week.